but not until essentially around the time of next year's election, till February next year. He joins us to talk about the newly released disability reform roadmap, but there is a lot to talk to him about. Our political panel too. It's coming up to news time and AM now. It's 7 o'clock.
ABC News. Good morning, I'm Simon Lauder. The leader of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah has promised revenge after a series of explosions targeting communication devices killed more than three dozen people. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah says the group will respond to the detonation of thousands of handheld radios and pagers this week at a time and in a way of its choosing. He concedes the attack, which killed 37 people and wounded nearly 3,500 others, was a heavy blow. But Hezbollah continues to fire rockets, drones and missiles into Israel, saying it won't stop until Israel withdraws from Gaza. Israel says the fighting with Hezbollah has entered a new phase and military action will continue.
Staff upheaval and frustrations with leadership are emerging inside the new government agency that's overseeing Australia's $368 billion AUKUS project to acquire nuclear-powered submarines. The ABC has learnt several senior figures have recently left, including the organisation's first assistant director overseeing the technical section. Australian Submarine Agency boss Vice Admiral Jonathan Mead has acknowledged long hours and work pressure is leading to some turnover, but insists the organisation is properly staffed.
No, we are not struggling to keep the most qualified people. We've got the most qualified people there, I said, and they come to work every day with this sense of purpose, the sense of purpose that they want to protect Australia and defend our national interests.
New documents from the Defence Force show women in the ADF are facing persistently high rates of harassment. Senators say Labor must hold defence leaders to account. Claudia Long has more from Parliament House.
Rates of unacceptable behaviour directed towards women, which takes in harassment, bullying and violence, have dropped at just one of the seven ADF training institutions surveyed in 2023. Greens Defence spokesperson David Shoebridge says the federal government must act.
It goes beyond a wake-up call. This is years and years and years of this showing in the data now.
The Royal Commission into Veterans Suicide called on Defence Minister Richard Marles to urgently ensure the ADF has a complete record of all serving members who've been convicted of sexual offences. But the federal government are yet to commit to putting that in place.
The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is heading off on a fleeting trip to the United States this weekend for a meeting of the Quad. National Affairs Editor Melissa Clark reports.
The Quad consists of the United States, India, Japan and Australia. The country's leaders will be meeting in the US President Joe Biden's home state of Delaware for the annual talks. They'll primarily be discussing security and defence issues in the Indo-Pacific, with China high on the agenda. The AUKUS agreement that will see Australia acquire nuclear-powered submarines from the US will also be a key item on the agenda. It will be the last Quad meeting for Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who are both nearing the end of their term in office.
The peak body for secondary school principals in Australia says an increase in families choosing homeschooling shows schools are under-resourced. Sasha Payne reports.
More than 43,000 Australian children are registered to homeschool, more than double the number registered in 2018. The president of the Australian Secondary Principals Association, Andy Meisen, says teachers would love to offer the same level of individualised learning as homeschooling, but simply aren't resourced to do so.
You've got a teacher shortage in Australia and an increased expectation that schools will be all things to all people.
Mr. Meisen says there's a place for homeschooling, but parents need to be mindful of the challenges, including the need for children to socialise with their peers.
An annual survey of drug users across Australia's capital city shows most believe it was easier to access illegal drugs such as ecstasy and cocaine this year. The National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre has been surveying hundreds of regular drug users from Australia's capital cities for two decades. Deputy Director Dr. Rachel Sutherland says there were several trends this year, including participants reporting perceived easier access to some illegal drugs. She says the non-prescribed use of legal drugs for ADHD also increased.
So one of the other notable findings is around the use of pharmaceutical stimulants. So this year we found that about half of our sample of people who use ecstasy or other stimulants had used non-prescribed pharmaceutical stimulants in the past 6 months.
Community consultation will begin today on a new category of disability supports to be set up outside the NDIS. More from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
More than 2,000 people are registered to attend the virtual consultation on foundational supports. Those were a key recommendation from last year's NDIS review. More in-person and virtual events will take place across the country over the coming months. Focus will start on information and capacity building supports to help people and their families before moving on to targeted supports such as those for children with developmental delay.
The Australian Lawyers Alliance says Victoria's Department of Public Prosecutions could potentially challenge a decision to discharge a diabetic driver who killed five people northwest of Melbourne. Costa Haritos reports.
William Swales' lawyers successfully argued he did not have a case to answer because he was suffering from a hypoglycemia episode brought on by his diabetes when he crashed outside the Royal Daylesford Hotel last November, killing five people. Lawyer Greg Barnes, SC, says the DPP has the power to directly indict Mr. Swale, which could see the matter return to court.
That's been part of the fabric of the criminal justice system in Victoria for some time.
In making his decision, the magistrate said the case showed a lack of evidence relating to the issue of whether the 67-year-old voluntarily got behind the wheel. Families of those killed say the decision has left them questioning the justice system.
Victorian police officers will stop handing out on-the-spot traffic fines from today in an escalation of a protracted dispute with the state government over pay and conditions. Officers have already been writing messages on the sides of police vehicles and warning motorists about speed cameras as part of their push for a 24% pay rise and shorter shift times. A man's in hospital after being shot twice in an early morning home invasion in Sydney's west. Anushree Sood has the details.
Emergency services arrived at the Wetherill Park House at about 3:30 this morning. Paramedics found the man in his 30s with gunshot wounds to his leg and hand. They treated him at the scene. Police say his injuries are not life-threatening and he was taken to hospital for further treatment. Police have established a crime scene and are investigating the incident. Anyone with information about the shooting is asked to contact police or Crime Stoppers.
Returning overseas and the new owners of London's luxury department store Harrods say they're utterly appalled by sexual abuse allegations made against former owner, the late Mohamed Al-Fayed. Europe correspondent Mazoe Ford reports.
Mohamed Al-Fayed faced sexual assault claims when he was alive, but the allegations revealed by the BBC are unprecedented in scale and seriousness. 20 women claim Al-Fayed sexually assaulted them when they worked at Harrods. Five say they were raped. Egyptian-born Al-Fayed owned the world-famous department store from 1985 to 2010. He's become known to a new generation through his depiction in the Netflix series The Crown. His son Dodi was killed in a car crash alongside Diana, Princess of Wales. Mazoe Ford, ABC News London.
With sport now, here's Daniela Intilli.
Robbie Fox is coming to Sydney's AFL preliminary final team to face Port Adelaide tonight at the SCG. The utility replaces Swans captain Callum Mills, while the Power has recalled key forward Charlie Dixon and defender Ryan Burton in the place of Todd Marshall and Will Lorenz. Geelong veteran Zach Tui has been dropped for Saturday's preliminary final against Brisbane at the SCG in favour of defender Tom Stewart. The Lions have made no changes. Richmond have moved into the AFLW's top four after thrashing Carlton by 33 points at Prince's Park. In her 50th club game, midfielder Monique Conti collected 32 disposals for the Tigers, but has told Fox Sports it was a team effort.
We have a really equal role to play, all of us, and when we spread the load like that, we win games.
Australia have won the first men's cricket one-day international against England by 7 wickets in Nottingham. Meanwhile, the Australian women's team have defeated New Zealand by 5 wickets in their T20 series opener in Mackay. The Australian Diamonds held off England 70-57 in the first netball test in Adelaide. And Melbourne United opened the new NBL season with an 88-79 win over the Tasmania Jack Jumpers in their Championship Series rematch in Perth.
To finance, Wall Street has closed at record highs a day after the US Federal Reserve's big cut to interest rates. The S&P 500 is up 1.7%, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1.2%, the NASDAQ up 2.5%. The local share market is expected to open higher, the ASX SPY 200 futures up 0.3%, and the Australian dollar is higher, trading at 68.1 US cents.
Across Australia, you're listening to Breakfast on RN.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Ngunnawal country in Canberra and acknowledging other custodians. The leader of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah says a devastating series of explosions will not stop the group from fighting against Israel. Dozens of Hezbollah members were killed and thousands were wounded when their mobile paging devices and handheld radios exploded on Tuesday and Wednesday. The attacks also killed civilians and have left the group and the wider Lebanese population reeling. Our Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
After funerals were held for the Hezbollah members killed when their communications devices exploded, the group's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, addressed his followers.
What can we call this criminal act? It was a huge terrorist act. It is a genocide. It is a massacre. We will use the term the massacre of Tuesday and the massacre of Wednesday.
The blasts killed 37 people, including 2 children, and wounded 3,500. Hezbollah blames Israel.
The Israeli enemy targeted thousands of pagers and they were detonated at the same time. The enemy violated in this operation all the rules, laws and red lines. They didn't care about anything at all, not morally, humanely or legally.
Hassan Nasrallah concedes the attacks are a harsh blow, but won't stop Hezbollah from firing rockets, drones and missiles into Israel, which the group's been doing since October last year.
We say to the enemy's government, army and society that the Lebanese front will not stop before the aggression on Gaza stops.
As Israeli warplanes break the sound barrier in the skies above Beirut, many Lebanese are now asking where Hezbollah's campaign is leading the country. Beirut resident Michelle Shebli says the Lebanese find themselves caught between fear and frustration.
It's a bit like Groundhog Day. Every single time you feel that the boundaries have been pushed a bit further. And I'm against violence, but at the same time, like, violence has been imposed upon us for 75 years.
The attacks have shown just how great Israel's technological and operational advantages are over Hezbollah. American University of Beirut history lecturer Makram Rabah says the group's weaknesses have been exposed.
So ultimately, if Hezbollah wants to engage in open warfare with Israel, it has to actually maintain and fortify its internal front, which everyone knows at the moment is in utter shambles.
The attacks also highlight the major challenge confronting Lebanon, how to end the sectarian conflicts and associated militancy that have left the country with a collapsed economy and dysfunctional government.
It has reminded the Lebanese that Hezbollah will remain a problem until they are politically stood against and confronted by the Lebanese, who should in a way reconstruct the state to try to pacify the danger that Iran and Hezbollah pose on Lebanon.
Israel has not taken responsibility for the explosions, but its defence minister says the fighting against Hezbollah has entered a new phase and that military action will continue.
That's Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek. 2 years ago, Sri Lanka was on the brink of bankruptcy. Months of protests eventually led to the former president fleeing the country and protesters entering the presidential palace. Tomorrow, Sri Lankans will vote in their first presidential election since the crisis. South Asia correspondent Ellie Grounds reports from Colombo.
In 2022, after months camped out protesting against Sri Lanka's president, Colombo resident Nixon finally got a good night's sleep in a bed in the country's presidential palace.
Like a luxury room, luxury place, no sound, but we enjoyed really well because we have so tired. We stayed at more than 90 days and I really feel I slept 3 days non-stop.
Nixon was one of thousands of protesters who entered the residence of former President Gotabaya Rajapaksa after he fled the country. A series of missteps by his government, including crippling international debts and tax cuts, plus allegations of corruption, had plunged the country into economic turmoil. Inflation had shot to 70% and a severe shortage of essentials left Sri Lankans queuing for hours in the heat for fuel, gas and medicine. Nixon's pizza business became impossible to run.
They spoiled the economy, they spoiled the country, everything, economic crisis, everything.
The current president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, was installed days later and under a bailout agreement with the International Monetary Fund, has brought inflation back down to just 0.5%. Tomorrow's election is largely being seen as a referendum on how he has handled the mammoth task of getting Sri Lanka's economy back on track. And while some see him as an economic saviour...
Ranil Wickremesinghe saved the country. No more queues. He will win this election and Sri Lanka will have a better future.
Others say they're still hurting under his government. Digital marketer Sahana Peres says increased taxes brought in under the IMF deal have made providing for her family of five difficult.
All goods prices going increased. So we sometimes the milk powder was, I think it's triple from the before price. So we reduced use that one.
She hasn't decided who she's going to vote for tomorrow, but she's sure of one thing.
I need the change.
Political expert Dr. Pakasothi Saravanamutu says that is the other defining theme of this election.
So this election is all about this notion of system change. The social contract of the country is in pieces, and we therefore have to redesign a new social contract.
That desire to leave the political establishment behind is what's led to three frontrunners emerging in a Sri Lankan presidential election race for the first time. Alongside opposition leader Sajit Premadasa, the leader of a leftist alliance, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, is a strong contender to take power. His main appeal to voters, a promise to end the corruption that critics allege has consistently plagued Sri Lankan governments of the past.
These politicians have ruined this country and we have gone to the drain now. So step by step we have to come up.
While many are hopeful this election might bring significant change, there are also fears the result may affect the trajectory of Sri Lanka's economic recovery. This is Ellie Grounds in Colombo reporting for AM.
You're listening to AM where it's 17 past 7. And for more news, you can download the ABC Listen app. Coming up on Radio National Breakfast, outgoing Minister for the NDIS, Bill Shorten, will join Patricia Karvelis after the release of the government's disability reform roadmap. After a week where housing policy was front and centre of the political debate, the housing advocacy sector has come away less than impressed with progress on one of the country's biggest issues. The Albanese government has failed to pass a key piece of legislation, even failing to get the Senate to vote on the bill at all. The Greens and several crossbenchers say they're trying to pressure the government into making the legislation more ambitious, while one independent senator has called on her colleagues to accept an imperfect bill. Isabel Rowe reports.
Australians are saddled with an entrenched per capita recession, negative productivity.
On the final day of a frustrating 2 weeks for the government, emotions were high on the Senate floor.
All of them need to go and see a doctor because I think they have the worst case of
corporate and political amnesia.
The government is being blocked at every turn on its Help to Buy housing policy, a piece of legislation it says will make purchasing a home easier for low-income Australians by paying up to 40% of the price of a new property. Labor isn't negotiating with the Greens, refusing their requests for changes, things like rent freezes or removing negative gearing. But the government doesn't have the support, leading Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to declare the bill effectively defeated. In the Senate, the government is accusing those sitting opposite of playing games.
They think that if they make the problem worse, it'll be better for them politically. It'll be better for them politically.
Labor Senator Penny Wong has pointed to the Coalition as the architects of the housing shortage.
They've offered no help, no plans for people struggling, just more negativity, and then they cuddle up to the Greens to help push urgent housing.
Elsewhere in the building, Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young lamented on the government's struggle to pass its agenda.
What is wrong with this government? Can't they just be better?
Just one senator sided with the government as it tried to bring on a vote on the Help to Buy bill. Independent Senator for Tasmania, Tammy Tyrrell, says her crossbench colleagues are making perfect the enemy of the good.
If they want to negotiate for pie in the sky, you know, idealism, go them. But the longer that they wait, the longer that they stall, it's less houses that are actually going to be kicked into gear sooner.
The Greens would say that they're trying to get a better outcome here. They're trying to get the government to do more. Do you see it like that?
I see politics as cooperation and collaboration. And from what I'm seeing, there's no cooperation and there's no collaboration. There's a line been put in the sand and nobody's budging.
As politicians squabble over who should move first in negotiations, the housing sector is not impressed. May Aziz is the spokesperson for housing advocacy group Everybody's Home.
What we're seeing is a big political bun fight that's been talked up and where the government is spending a lot of political capital, but where the stakes are actually pretty low, because whether or not this bill passes won't make a big difference to housing affordability in Australia. Everything that the government is doing here is really geared towards looking like they're taking on this crisis. And I guess that's the concern that we've got about this debate.
Instead of the Help to Buy bill, she says the government could be tackling bigger reforms.
There are two really big things that the government could be doing to make a long-term impact on affordability. And the first is building homes to rent itself. This is what Australia used to do back when we had affordable housing. The government used to build at the height about one in four new builds through the public sector, and that had a really big impact in keeping housing costs down. The other thing we need it to do is fix the tax system, because that's pushing up housing costs and it's sucking a lot of money out of the system that we could be spending on affordable homes.
Debate on the bill has now been delayed, with the government planning to reintroduce it in the House of Representatives and try again. Greens leader Adam Bandt has told 7:30 Labor should use this time to make the bill stronger.
We're hopeful that during this now 2-month negotiation period, the government's prepared to stop bulldozing and start negotiating, and we're prepared to work with them.
Whether that invitation is accepted remains to be seen.
That's Isabel Rowe reporting. A national drug trend report has found that the use of pharmaceutical stimulants by those who haven't been prescribed them has reached its highest recorded level. The drugs include those used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. But researchers say it is tricky to pinpoint exactly why. Kathleen Ferguson reports.
For Kate Melville, ADHD medication makes life more manageable.
It kind of makes my brain sleep a bit, which is kind of unusual considering what it is called, but it calms it all down. It soothes things out a bit. And so instead of thinking about 25 different things at once, I'm actually able to concentrate and focus on one thing.
But ADHD drugs don't have a calming effect for everyone.
I think it really makes me realise that I actually need it, because it doesn't do that for me. I've definitely had friends and, you know, people who do it for like recreational purposes, and it just gives them that buzz. And it just doesn't do that to me.
The National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre has released its latest drug trends report, including its data for ecstasy and other stimulants. It's designed to identify trends and isn't representative of the Australian population. The program's lead is Dr. Rachel Sutherland.
So we interviewed 740 people who regularly use ecstasy or other stimulants. And one of the key findings that we found was around the non-prescribed use of pharmaceutical stimulants. We did find that 54% of our sample reported using non-prescribed pharmaceutical stimulants, such as dexamphetamine, dimethylphenidate, which is, you know, the highest percentage observed since the study began.
So why are people taking these drugs? Rachel Sutherland again.
Yeah, I mean, as with any substance, there might be a variety of reasons why people use these drugs. So they are stimulants. So a lot of previous research has shown that people might use them to help them study or to help them focus. There's studies which have shown that people might use them to help self-medicate. And then, of course, there's also studies that show that people might use them for the kind of energy boost or just to experiment or to get high.
She says it's hard to pinpoint why the rates might be going up in the sample studies.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a little bit tricky to say exactly what might be driving particular trends. We do know that, you know, ADHD is being increasingly recognised and diagnosed globally and in Australia. And alongside that, there's been an increase in the prescribing of medicines to treat ADHD, such as the pharmaceutical stimulants. So this increase in the prescribing of these drugs potentially creates, you know, more of an opportunity for these medicines to be diverted into the illicit drug market.
Dr. Michael Cohen is the Professor of Paediatrics at the University of Western Sydney and is a former chair of ADHD Australia. He says it's important to put the findings in perspective.
The context of this study is very important. The study highlights in a select population a high risk of diversion, but this is not a finding which is generalisable to the general community.
He says these drugs can be life-changing for people living with ADHD.
Medications for ADHD are effective and helpful for the population where there's been a clinical diagnosis and the medications taken in a prescribed manner.
It's former ADHD Australia Chair Dr. Michael Cohen ending that report from Kathleen Ferguson. With fewer people around the world drinking wine, grape growers are increasingly pulling out vines and searching for alternative crops. Now, amid a global shortage of olive oil, a more efficient way of farming olives that allows grape growers to use their existing machinery is presenting a golden opportunity. Eliza Bellage reports.
Between the rows are some of the oldest vines in Australia's biggest wine-producing region, a new crop is bringing hope.
A little bit crazy. My neighbours asked me, what the hell you're doing? But we thought, let's pull out the young vines, let's preserve the old vines. And with the old vines we pulled out, we put in Don Carlo olives.
While some wine grape growers in South Australia's Riverland are bracing for a fourth year of having to sell wine below the cost of production, viticulturist Ashley Ratcliffe has planted olive trees to diversify his business. But these aren't ordinary olive trees. These super high-density olive trees can be planted much closer together than traditional trees and are trellised like a hedge. It allows for more efficient fruit production and easier harvesting using existing vineyard equipment.
That's the key thing, was we didn't want to go out and buy an olive harvester or an olive pruner. We want to be able to use the machinery we've got ourselves.
Around 36% of the world's supply of extra virgin olive oil is grown using this method. Berry Barmer Council Mayor Ella Winnell is supportive of grape growers who want to switch to olives.
The olive opportunity has some really unique aspects of it that will have long-term benefits for our community.
She's hoping that with some farmers diversifying their business this way, it'll help to future-proof the region. Local industry body Riverland Wine says this region has lost almost $600 million in revenue in the last 3 years because of the lower price of grapes. People are also drinking less wine, with the International Organisation of Vine and Wine showing last year was the lowest level of consumption since 1996.
And there's probably not many people in the Berrybarra community that aren't either employed by the wine industry or know someone closely who's employed by the wine industry.
Demand for these super high density trees is growing, especially because they can produce fruit in as little as 2 years. Sav Catanzariti's family have been early adopters and say the investment at their groves just outside of Adelaide has paid off.
So back in 1998, my mum and dad decided to plant 4,000 trees. Dad wanted to keep the trees reasonably close together so it'd be suitable for high-density harvesting.
These trees have helped his business bring in more than 100 awards for their oil, and he sees the value of this farming method for other growers.
As you're aware, the olive oil price is relatively high. It spiked due to a shortage of olives being produced this year due to climate and weather conditions. So there's always opportunity and good opportunity, actually, for a lot of growers to get involved in the olive oil game.
Mr. Catanzariti has even been processing oil for other growers, like Mr. Ratcliffe, who believes olive oil production is a great chance for some farmers to return to their ancestral roots.
Some of their backgrounds, a lot of them are Greek and Italian. I mean, they're very good at growing olives, so they're quite excited to do something that maybe their grandparents did many years ago.
That's viticulturalist Ashley Ratcliffe ending that report from Eliza Bellage, and you can see more of that story on Landline on ABC TV on Sunday or on iView. In finance, Wall Street stocks have surged to record highs after the US Federal Reserve slashed interest rates by half a percentage point. And that's AM. I'm Sally Sara. It's 7:30. And good morning, Patricia Karvelas.
Good morning, Sally, and good morning to you. You're listening to ABC Radio National Breakfast. The top stories we're following this morning. The government has released its disability reform roadmap for the next 12 months. The outgoing NDIS Minister, Bill Shorten, joins me in a moment to talk about that, but lots of other political issues that are on the agenda today as well. Later this morning, you'll hear from one of more than 100 Republican members and national security officials who have written an open letter endorsing the Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris. You'll hear from one of those who drafted the letter. First, Richard Crabtree is here with an update of the news headlines at 7:30. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, PK. The Israeli military says its fighter jets have struck more than 100 Hezbollah rocket launches with airstrikes in southern Lebanon in the last few hours. The strikes come shortly after the leader of Hezbollah promised revenge for the explosion of communications devices, which has killed at least 37 people in Lebanon in the last 2 days. In his first televised remarks since the incident, Hezbollah said Israel will face a bitter reckoning for the attacks. Former Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick has joined the Jackie Lambie Network and will run for the Senate at the next election. Patrick served as a senator for 5 years after he filled the vacancy caused by the resignation of Nick Xenophon in 2017. In a social media post, Patrick said he would work with Senator Lambie to give the political and bureaucratic fat cats some big knocks.